Ready to take a deeper look at where history, politics, and economics all intersect? Well, then you've come to the right place. Each week, here's where we pull back the headlines and focus on the big trends, the stuff that actually shapes our future. Through the noise, we focus on the signal. I'm your host, Neil Howe, and this is Demography Unplugged. Today is June 23rd, 2020, and this is Demography Unplugged. Welcome back, everybody. As we did last week, I have on my podcast my fellow analyst, Christian Ford. Christian?
How you doing, Neil?
I take it it's hot in Maine.
Yes, it is 88 degrees and humid as can be.
Yeah, exactly. I have a daughter living in Montreal. She confirms the same thing. I was born and raised in California, and I've always considered one of the most curious aspects of East Coast weather is that it can often be hotter in the north than down here where I am in Virginia. And in addition to the fact that the spring and the fall here often can only last a week or two, just to add to the enjoyment of the seasons. Well, as always, if you want to dive deeper into everything we talk about on this podcast, please consider subscribing to our research product, Demography Unplugged, which I put together with my team at Hedge Eye Risk Management. Google it and find it. Among other things, you would be able to get our newswire and watch my show on COVID-19, all of our special reports, special interviews with guests. This week, in fact, tomorrow, I will be interviewing Andrew Friedman, director of Hedge Eye's media and communications sector. So we're going to be talking about why there is so much on Netflix, but so little that I want to watch. but Andy is great, and he is an amazing guy, and he's I love the way he talks about the media. And clearly, he's been very much in contrast recently when we did the restaurant sector. Andy is a guy who's whose sector is booming, right? Generally doing very well. Communications, particularly the subscription paid media, not so much, not so much the traditional networks. But anyway, we're going to be talking a lot about that and a lot about transformations of our nation's economy. I mean, as a lot of these companies assume a larger and larger share of the S&P 500, what does that say? And we will even be talking about antitrust and the growing threat of regulation of his sector. So today on our podcast, we have our usual hopelessly ambitious agenda. So markets and economic indicators, I know we're up. We're going to talk a little bit about COVID recently. Earnings season is about to start. As we get into July. So we'll be talking a little bit about that. And I want to pause to talk a bit about the Fed now thinking seriously about putting caps on the yield curve, really just nailing the yield curve in place, so to speak, formally tying it down. What the Bank of Japan formally did in 2016, and does this mark the Japanification of the U.S. economy? What is the end game for that? I'm not sure about the answers, but I do want to talk about it. We have some political stories abroad, and I do want to talk about one story that we put out on this week's Newswire, which I thought was an interesting one. The title of the story is "America is Registering Record Levels of Unhappiness." And this is according to the National Opinion Research Center at the University of Chicago. And we've had a number of stories like this in response to the pandemic. And where does that say about I hate to be a purveyor of gloom, but this really is a remarkable story, I think, in many respects. And then finally, if we have time, Christian, I want to talk about something we did not have time to discuss when we were with our political analyst, J.T. Taylor, and that is Joe Biden's vice presidential picks. What do they look like? Who's first in line? What's the strategy there? What are the odds? I don't know. What are the pros and cons there? If we have time, we want to get to that. So let's just, without more ado, plunge right in. Maybe we'll start with you, Christian, about markets.
All right, Neil. Well, over the last four trading days, the S&P 500 is down 0.22%. Not much movement there. But the global Dow is up 1.9%. And if we look to volatility, the VIX closed yesterday at 31.77. Last week, it was in a similar place, that low 30 mark.
Right. And we're still above 30. I'm sure for a lot of people, right, that's nonetheless a relief. I think they see that as a step back toward normalization. The fact that Europe has done so well, we're going to talk about that in a second, particularly right. Today. Today was a big day in the stock market, positive day. And I think that has something to do with, that has something to do with economic indicators. So we might as well talk about that. Maybe it's a good thing actually to start with Europe. What did we see today? We saw PMIs, right?
Yep, we got market flash PMIs for the Eurozone for June. Manufacturing came in at 46.9. Now, that's its highest reading in 4 months. It's still below 50, so still a contraction, but not as devastating as, say, May when it came in at 39.4. For services, we had 47.3, and for composite, it came in at 47.5. So they're all in that upper 40s range.
I hate to say this, but they're still shrinking.
Right.
I mean, is it embarrassing for me to point out? But below 50 means it's still contracting. And I do want to add one other thing. The last time the Eurozone manufacturing PMI was above 50, that is to say expanding, was in January of 2019. Right. So this is the
right.
What? This is the 16th month in a row of shrinkage. Well, that doesn't sound good to me. Am I not onto something there?
It doesn't sound good to me either, Neil.
But you're right. I mean, services obviously was doing better before the pandemic, and it's back to 47. I think this was basically a sense that a bullet had been dodged, right? They're expecting something much worse, and so they kind of, it was a relief rally, I guess, and maybe that's the technical name. And then what about the U.S.?
The U.S. also got market PMI flashes for June. Manufacturing came in at 49.6, services at 46.7, and composite at 46.8. So just like the Eurozone, Neil, high 40s still means we're having contractions.
Right. Not exactly the V-shaped recession we were thinking of. But, you could say that America is going back to work, or maybe more to the point, America's shopping again. We're going to see where that goes. Before we move on, I think you did have a couple of remarks about Japan. Is that correct?
Yeah. Well, we similarly got PMI flashes for June. Manufacturing came in at 37.8. Now, that's worse than May, which was at 38.4. That's its lowest reading since April of 2009. Now, we also got services. That was actually better, came in at 42.3. Now, this is being attributed to the state emergency that was technically throughout Japan was lifted in June. So there was a little bit more movement, still contraction. And composite came in at 37.9.
So I can only imagine that Japan's incredibly low manufacturing PMI is related to exports. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And do we see this in, I mean, think of the other big export economies, South Korea.
Right.
And I don't know, we'll have to look up, I don't know, maybe next time we'll talk about South Korea's PMIs. Germany, I'm thinking of the big export ones, and we know that Germany's having a problem there, right? So, Japan is interesting. And Japan, obviously, this wasn't a supply shock. Japan has been relatively untouched by COVID-19. Yet it is going into the most extraordinary set of economic and monetary stimulus measures in its history. And I will talk about that later when I talk about what the Fed is doing and this whole thesis of the Japanification of the U.S. economy, because Japan continues to pave new inroads. And I'll come back to that in a little bit. A lot of the rebound in the stock market is, the saying now is going around that the market is relieved that what could have been a depression is merely turning into a severe recession. So that's an interesting way to look at it, although I guess you could come back and say the markets have reacted in the past a lot more severely to a severe recession. And I think one of the difference, obviously, is the policy responses we've seen. Two negatives and a big positive. And I would say right now, as I observe the market reaction and look at the economy, I would say two negatives are beginning to cloud the horizon. One is COVID. As opposed to 3 or 6 weeks ago, Christian, the situation around the world, and particularly in the United States, does not look nearly so positive on the pandemic. Around the world, the infection and the death rate is reaccelerating. And the big news, and we certainly report this on our COVID show, is the emerging markets. South Asia, the Middle East now is beginning to become a huge hotspot. Sub-Saharan Africa is beginning to participate in this, particularly South Africa recently. And obviously, as we all know, almost all of Latin America, with high R-naught figures now in Argentina, Chile, Ecuador, and a few others. I think we're going to talk later about Brazil and that hopeless situation. But in the U.S., as of last count, if you look at 10-day moving averages, case numbers are rising in 26 states in the United States, declining in 16. Okay, this is a real turnaround. And for a long time, you had the Northeast was declining, and most of the rest of the country had not yet really got it. Now that's really changing. The Northeast is kind of out of danger. They're not really declining that much anymore, but you see a lot of these other areas in the country certainly certainly growing. I have my map out here, Christian. This is my epiforecast map of the United States, divided into increasing and decreasing and not sure, and virtually the entire South, with the exception of Mississippi and with the exception of New Mexico, and all the way up the West Coast is increasing. And the only part of America that's clearly decreasing is Michigan, Illinois, and Massachusetts, New York, and Pennsylvania, and New Jersey, just around there. It is really remarkable, this change, and I think this had something to do with something in the news just a couple of days ago, and that was the Tulsa, Oklahoma rally for President Trump. I think this was well reported in all the media, right? He filled 6,200 seats in a 19,000 capacity auditorium, and there was a lot of back and forth. The Democrats were crowing that, no one showed up, and he was saying, well, they were scared to come because of Antifa or something. I mean, I really couldn't care less to follow this kind of stuff. I do think, though, that the fear of infection and the fear of violence, even though the fear of violence turned out to be completely unjustified. Nonetheless, I mean, there are a lot of Trump supporters with families who probably feel that, you know, it's probably not a great safe place to come, particularly since that tremendous buildup, right? And the media was partly responsible for that around this event. But it does lead to a really interesting question. What kind of campaign are we going to have without rallies? This is not going to go away, right? Particularly if it gets worse over the summer, and who knows what's going to happen by the time October rolls around. I guess this is a campaign which is going to be increasingly waged through social media. You've got Dan Scavino, that's the social media director. He basically superintends all of Trump's tweets. And he's known for extremely dramatic flair. I remember one great one he had. He loves playing off Game of Thrones. So that's wonderful. It looked like a screenshot of a movie ad with Trump's face, and the headline was "Sanctions are coming." And a little thing down below, you know, and this isn't the build up to the Iran. A very creative guy. He's a light wave Xer. He's in his early 40s. And Brad Parscale, who's his digital advisor, and he's a big white guy with a Viking beard. I think he's age 44. So again, you know, light wave Xer. And he has a social media empire. I think you can say, I think it's fair to say, that unlike during the Obama presidencies, the Democrats have no real built-in advantage anymore when it comes to social media. I remember that was, you know, always the big extra edge, you know, back in 2008 and 2012. I think in 2016, Trump's social media, and particularly his tweeting campaign, took everyone by surprise and turned out to be extraordinarily cost effective because he was constantly in the news without paying for any advertising. that was an amazing performance. And what is your sense, Christian, as we see, you know, Trump's social media campaign go up against Obama's? Obviously, Obama is obviously not as skilled as Trump. He's a little bit older, you know, maybe a half generation removed. Trump has adapted very well to it. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts?
I think one of the reasons Trump is so successful is that his tweeting seems like it wasn't thought up in some room with everyone debating the perfect word. And I think Biden's going to be way more conventional. But I think Trump's way of just tweeting what he thinks is more effective. And I think that's going to be a struggle for Biden.
Well, I think you're right about that. And this is probably the one most, the one thing that people, you know, even people who don't like Trump will tell you, that he's authentic. He might be right. An authentic madman. All right. And the last person in the world I want to be president. But I think the fact that he does seem utterly transparent with regard to his emotions is a very unusual trait. It's very difficult to simulate, almost by definition. Yeah. That reminds me of that old George Burns joke, sincerity, you know, the most important thing in life. You know, fake that, you got it made, right? Anyway, It is an interesting aspect of Trump. I do think one thing you're going to see is a very disquieting sense, I think, in America as we get closer to the election, that, you know, more and more is done on social media. There are fewer and fewer actual events. People aren't actually seeing people anymore. Everyone's going to be more mystified about what the rest of America actually thinks. And I think we're going to talk about unhappiness in just a second. But I think that's generating a significant amount of unhappiness in America. It's all these changes going on politically, all of these stressors in the economy and in our institutional outlook, at the same time that everyone feels isolated. So they really aren't sure what anyone else is thinking. And I think that's also causing kind of an amping up of the whole cancel culture. On the left and the right, I would say recently, probably more on the left. But, you know, it goes back and forth. I But I think this is certainly a cause of sort of psychological unease. Anyway, moving on to the earnings season, it is going to start in what, just a couple of weeks. I don't know what they still start with Alcoa now. As many of the listeners probably gather, I don't exactly do the. I'm not a sector head. I don't usually go down, you know, my tickers and know exactly when their earnings reports are coming out. But we are going to see another earnings season. According to FactSet, the second quarter will be down year over year by 44%. In Q1, it was down year over year 14%. So this is going to be another massive, you know, hugely massive drop. There are a lot of downward revisions, and there are fewer updates than usual. So I think there will be more surprises. A lot of companies claim they really can't tell in advance where they're going to end up, not just in terms of revenues, but especially in terms of, you know, their margins, their earnings. All sectors are expected to be down. The worst off will be energy, consumer discretionary, industrials, and financials. The least down will be the interest rate-dependent sectors like utilities and real estate, and obviously infotech. That overlaps a little bit with communications and, you know, the Amazons, the Big Fang world, and they're expected to do well. They're certainly going to do well. This will be the fifth decline in the last six quarters. Remember, we had three negative quarters in a row in 2019. We were somewhat slightly positive in the fourth quarter, and then, of course, we've just gone into negative again. By the way, in case anyone's interested for Q2, it's expected to get on 44%. The biggest registered single year-over-year decline, according to FactSet, was 69% decline in the fourth quarter of 2008. Now, we have no idea what Q2 will do. Again, this 44 is just an estimate. It might be considerably greater. It might rival 2008. And along with those other, you know, declines, this could spook markets. So I'm saying this is the other negative right now on the horizon. We've talked about the accelerating growth, the positive R-naught in so many states. And around the world, I think that's one. And I think our earnings season coming ahead, when we finally see, you know, what's going on with these companies, you know what, where they actually stand now that they've been through the whole second quarter. But now that brings me to the huge positive. What's keeping this whole thing from becoming a panic, right? And who is keeping the markets up? And there's no question in my mind, along with, you know, the CARES Act and these, you know, four huge stimulus bills of greater magnitude coming out of Congress, is the Fed, all in the name of reducing liquidity, right? And as some of us ask, but what about insolvency? Do you know, does that ever come into your? No. Everything we do is just to, to enhance liquidity is what I meant. You know, making sure that everything remains liquid. But again, differentiating between liquidity, illiquidity, and insolvency at a time of crisis like this is always very difficult. And we see that challenge again. The one thing I thought was really remarkable now is the growing talk that the Fed is going to put caps on the government bond yield. In other words, they're instead of doing quantitative easing, say we're going to simply buy so much in 5-year, 10-year, whatever, to keep the yield curve down. We're just going to say this is going to be the yield curve, and we're going to buy whatever it takes, you know, to use Mario Draghi's phrase. And there will thereby being go the way of the Bank of Japan, as I suggested earlier, which made that decision formally in September of 2016. It has been done in the past. The Fed actually did this in synchrony with the Treasury Department from our entry into World War II until 1951. This was the era of financial repression and the so-called, deal that the Fed was simply going to be the lapdog of Treasury. Anyway, they did that. They kept the yield curve down. The Japanese experience, interestingly, is that once you make the promise to do it, you don't need to buy many bonds, actually, because with a guarantee, no one's really going to, you know, fight with the Fed. They know the Fed can buy as many as it wants, and so you actually don't even need to test it. What the Fed apparently is going to plan to do is buy all maturities through the end of 2022. So any of you saw the most recent FOMC conference, the meeting, the Fed said that they expect the rates to remain zero through the end of 2022. So clearly the first thing you want to do is, you know, all your 2 years, you want to make sure that they're all, they're all just nailed down at zero. But then you don't want the yield curve to suddenly go up steeply and make people wonder what's going to happen. See, then you got to buy some 3 years and some 5 years and probably even some 10 years. And then you got Jerome Powell saying, well, you get the most bang for your buck in terms of stimulus by buying the long term. So eventually what they're going to do is they're just going to come up with some yield curve that they think is appropriate for the economy and stick with it. You know, their ultimate goal is growth and inflation. That's what Jerome Powell says. Well, once we have growth and inflation again, you know, well, then we can lift it. You know, everything will be back healthy again. The question is, will we ever have growth and inflation again, right? Interestingly, much of what the Fed is doing, and I haven't really covered that much on this podcast, but I do find it interesting. There's a guy, actually, John Hussman, an economist, who has actually started a petition arguing that what the Fed is doing with regard to all of the backstopping that they're doing, not here in terms of buying up treasury debt, but everything that they're doing in terms of corporate debt, which obviously has to kind of be done along at the same time. If you're going to radically lower the treasury yield curve, you know, you also want to be backing up private sector debt. And his argument is that the Federal Reserve Act expressly permitted the Fed only to buy securities with government guarantees. Now, the Fed is getting around that by setting up special purpose vehicles. So what is happening is, under the CARES Act, the Treasury is providing seed money. So the Treasury then, Mnuchin will allocate certain money, is allocated by CARES Act, and they'll set up like, you know, $50 billion, you know, to buy up corporate debt. And then the Treasury, the Fed will say, okay, we got that 50, that will guarantee us. And the Treasury will actually be buying it. But given the fact that this is probably pretty good debt, we'll leverage that up 10 to 1. So now we can buy up to $500 billion, right? By the way, the Fed is doing all of its buying through intermediaries like BlackRock. Well, that's an interesting conflict of interest. BlackRock, last time I looked, actually creates most of the bond ETFs. In fact, they create most of the ETFs that go out on the market. Well, BlackRock says now it's not going to earn any fees. It's due to all this transaction for free. Yeah, but I mean, the Fed is basically printing money to maintain the value of all these things which you created. I think this is really interesting. And not only are they going to buy corporate investment grade ETFs, they're also going to buy fallen angels. So they will buy, and by the way, this isn't just ETFs. They're now saying they will, if necessary, buy individual corporate bonds, which is really interesting. That gets into all kinds of political issues, like, you know, which corporation you're going to buy, who do you know on the board at that company? I mean, in other words, this is what they wanted to avoid, and I think also what they want to avoid, particularly when it comes to backing up Moonies, you know, state and local, because that gets really political, right? And now I don't like Detroit, you know? But I really like Cincinnati or something. Anyway, so when it comes to fallen angels like Ford, Kraft Heinz, Occidental, a lot of these heavily leveraged old economy dinosaurs, they'll buy their debt too, even though they're no longer investment grade, you know, and a lot of us would say, why in the world are you betting, you know, the faith and credit of America on the future of Kraft Heinz? I mean, you know, the company that puts all that stuff in the middle of grocery stores that none of us, well, we either don't buy or we don't admit to buying, right? Anyway, an enormously leveraged company, you know, after they were bought out. And you wonder, again, it comes back to this issue of liquidity versus solvency. It's fine to create greater liquidity in the market, but my gosh, aren't these really strategic decisions they're making? Well, this gets down to Japan, and I wanted to return at some point to Japan, because Japan is going even further in the direction that we've been talking about. Shinzo Abe, Abe Shinzo now, they've reversed their names. Abe Shinzo is now generating a budget deficit this calendar year of 40% of GDP. And even when you exclude all the loan guarantees, which is part of that money, this is probably a 20% of GDP in April and May that they've been borrowing. That's extraordinary. That's bigger right now than the United States. They may go larger. He hasn't put any end to that. Japan is facing a near certain third quarter of contraction to, you know, the contraction started in Q4, Q1, this will be Q2. Japan's gross debt to GDP ratio is almost certain to go over 240% of GDP. And remember, Christian, Japan was relatively untouched by the pandemic. Right. How have the markets reacted to this? Complete complacency. No one's worried at all. Why? Because the Bank of Japan has the yield curve totally managed. It's not going to affect the prices of debt. It's not going to affect anything. They'll be recycling, the Japanese savings back into the economy. I think that's the idea. But this is where I'm going with all this. I'm thinking about the end game to what these, stimulus four, presumably, as we talked about with JT last week, presumably followed at the sometime near the end of July, possibly early September, early August with stimulus five and six, plus the Fed taking this route. Are we going in the same direction? And the real danger to me is that we move our entire economy into a new economic and social equilibrium, which is a pretty gloomy, steady state with no obvious end game or exit ramp. And that is we accept a low interest rate economy with chronic lack of consumer demand and employment, bargaining power by workers, combined probably with low rates of productivity growth, no business dynamism, no reallocation of capital between firms, and at the same time coupled by a high rate of return on S&P firms with all their moats, which continue to get almost free credit, you know, backed by the Fed, and a certain amount of financial repression. This is a gloomy scenario. It is an American economy that stumbles on, lacking productivity growth, which is the only certain source of rising living standards, and an increasing inequality of income, because, of course, all the winners who have invested in the big, you know, companies will just, those companies will keep leveraging themselves, you know, buying back stock, you know, borrowing more at next to nothing, buying back more stocks, returning the earnings to the economy that way. This is not a happy future. And people sometimes say this has to lead to inflation. Well, maybe not. You know, Richard Werner, the German economist, was the one who invented way back in the early, 2000s, the term quantitative easing. And he did so in response to what the Bank of Japan did, or what he recommended the Bank of Japan do after their own enormous, crash, coming out of 1999. And he pointed out that the inflation in goods and services are not necessarily linked to the inflation in investments, in financial instruments. You can have sort of indefinitely a two-tier economy. That's an interesting future. It's one that we do see certain signs of in Japan, along with the obvious demographic similarities of sort of aging economies. And one has to think that at some point you need to, there's a trade-off, right, between assuring liquidity not simply bolstering insolvency, extending and protecting and pretending. And how do you get out of that? You know, what is the exit ramp? I know there's a long debate among central bankers. You know, on the one side, you've got your purgative school. This is the Andrew Mellon, who was the Treasury Secretary under Herbert Hoover, who said, you know, liquidate labor, liquidate stocks, liquidate farmers, purge the rottenness out of this. So you got that extreme school. which it turns out, in the end, President Hoover did not follow. But of course he was, thrown out by a pretty healthy majority anyway in 1932. And then you've got the Walter Badgett School, which is that central banks should lend, early and freely, to solvent firms with good collateral, and at high rates. But again, solvent firms with good collateral. How do you judge solvency at a time of crisis? I think that is the, $3 trillion question right now. But there has to be a trade-off. And I think as more time goes on, the more the Fed and policymakers in general are going to have to try that, locate that trade-off, or else we're simply maintaining everything that's dysfunctional. All those companies that borrowed when they shouldn't have, right, leveraged themselves out of any comfort zone back in, 2015, 16, 17, 18, and 19, they're all getting bailed out. So basically, they've been vindicated. All of those bad decisions have been vindicated by this. This is moral hazard, to the very definition of moral hazard. And it's not just that it has long-term consequences. It will have consequences over the next few years. If I were to look at ways in which this is going to end, other than that kind of, gradual heat death of the universe scenario I just described, I would have to say that I see, a variety of ways in which this might end very suddenly and perhaps soon. One would be political resistance in Congress, business leaders, voters, to this sort of, endless cushioning of modern monetary theory, possibly amid further economic shocks, which we may see coming up, particularly if we see a resurgence in the pandemic. In other words, you might see further shocks and then the Fed simply tossing in the towel or failing to get both Treasury and the Fed failing to get the votes or failing to get the approval of policymakers. The other thing you might see is political shocks, because I do not think that the American people are happy about this direction, despite the fact, I'm going to come back to this later, but despite the fact that they're being completely anesthetized in a way or protected against the economic shock, they're not happy about it. So we may see contested elections. We may see mobilizations. We may be secession movements. We could see all. This is part of my fourth turning scenario, right? And this would very quickly change the economic outlook. And most importantly, it would put some immediate demands upon output right now, right? It would create a demand for resources now, sort of the equivalent of mobilization for war. But if that happens, then all bets are out the window and you don't get that that kind of steady state I was talking about. And the other is you see shorter-term political risks that may be milder in nature but just equally effective, and that would be a populist wave forces income transfers to ordinary households. This would push inflation, lower the dollar, and force the Fed to take action. You see, that would be the one thing that would give the Fed no choice, right? To back off, right? If we had actual inflation. And that would happen if You could imagine that happening in either party. I would say that'd be much more likely with the Democrats taking over, which right now doesn't seem entirely unlikely. Where you just say, okay, as long as we're bailing out business, let's bail out ordinary households. Let's give the same degree of largesse, right, to a new system of transfer payments, and then you really could see. You would move up the timetable on inflation. I don't know. What do you think, Christian? What are we looking at? This is my rambling at the moment about it.
I think Andrew Yang is laughing away, ready for UBI to come in.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, yeah. I mean, I can easily imagine Andrew Yang saying, "My God, if I had known that we could borrow for my universal benefit income and you know, at zero interest rates. I mean, what's the cost, right? we'll pay it back, you know, in a century when America's income is much larger." Okay. Now I want to move on to politics abroad, and I know you have a couple fascinating stories. I want you to get maybe mention them a bit.
Yeah, we have a crazy story going on in Brazil, and Neil, I feel like every week something more shocking happens with Bolsonaro's government, but last week he's really getting into some trouble. Now, a little background, there's an investigation into a lot of his political allies. They're being accused of running a disinformation campaign. They are supposedly paying journalists and bloggers to write fake stories against Bolsonaro's opponents. Now, last Monday and Tuesday, there was a series of arrests and search warrants.
I mean, you know, the Chinese Communist Party does that all the time. They pretend to be a democracy. You think that's the problem? Okay.
Right. So they have these arrests and warrants go out. All these officials who are involved start getting nervous, and they ask the Supreme Court to stop the investigation. Well, the Supreme Court, who has never gotten along with Bolsonaro, says there's nothing wrong with the investigation. Keep going. And one of Bolsonaro's biggest allies, he's the education minister, he resigns, and all of a sudden, next thing you know, he is in Miami. He has fled the country, fearing that he is going to jail.
Well,
and the people are outraged by this.
Yeah, I mean, the real question is how long is it going to, you know, I was only half kidding about the democracy part, because, you know, Brazil has had a history of, you know, reverting to... And not that long ago, too, you know, a couple of decades ago, before Lula da Silva, of military, you know, just moving back to military rule. And he has he's in good with the generals, right? At least some of them. Many of them are on his cabinet. Is it possible that Bolsonaro could just say, no one's going to impeach me. I'm kind of taken over.
He has made comments in the last few weeks suggesting that he has the military on his side. If the general sided with him, I could definitely see him just taking over. It's got to be which way the generals go, and it's a little unclear.
Well, we can hope it doesn't kind of get there in this country. Yeah. Okay, let's move on to India.
Yes, this was an absolutely crazy story, in my opinion. There is a section of the India-China border in the Himalayas where it's disputed where the line is, and China has troops there, India has troops, and there's this small section where they both have agreed that soldiers won't carry guns. Now, this supposedly is to stop some rogue soldier who accidentally shoots and creates a whole war. It's supposed to stop that. Well, a fight broke out of hand-to-hand combat. It was said that soldiers had clubs with barbed wire on them, and about 20 Indian soldiers died. It's unclear how many Chinese soldiers died. They were pushing each other off of cliffs. People were injured, couldn't escape. They froze to death. And in India, this story is an absolute outrage. And a lot of people are saying that the Indian government is now seriously looking to become much closer with the U.S. as U.S. and China relations start to deteriorate. You know, President Modi in India, he has called an emergency meeting with the opposition party. And It really doesn't look like there's going to be much coming back from this between the two countries.
Yeah, I guess that means no 5G with
Right.
Huawei.
Yeah.
It's now India has been trending that way for a while.
Right.
Toward the United States, really ever since 9/11. You saw that long movement. Back with Manmohan Singh was prime minister. This is just a further accentuation of it. I think China, there's very little news in China about this. I think China's trying to hush this up. I mean, China realizes that they're just kind of, frankly, pissing everybody off, around them, often for no real reason, right?
Right.
There's for a leadership known for its strategy and doing everything for strategic reasons, it doesn't often seem in these cases, like for instance, sending out all these, threats to Taiwan is another example, right? Simply to harden their resolve, right? You wonder if they're in full control of what their lieutenants out in the field are doing.
Right.
All right, I think we did have one story, something, an interesting piece on Italy and Spain. Is that right?
Right, this was a Financial Times story, and it was talking about the north and south divide in these countries. Both in Italy and Spain, the northern regions are much more prosperous, and the southern regions are, frankly, poor. They rely more on tourism. And during COVID, interestingly enough, the northern regions have been hit hardest by actual COVID cases and deaths. But it's the south that's expected to really take a hit to the economy. No one's traveling for a long time, and even though they had less cases and deaths, their economy's got to be hurt. And so you're gonna get this weird scenario in both Italy and Spain where government spending's probably got to go to the south, even though the north had the worst cases, and they think this is going to create some pretty major tensions between these regions.
Well, it's already there.
Right.
Catalonia feels that it's funding Andalusia. You got Madrid too. I guess Madrid, Catalonia. Well, they can't. I guess they don't get along with each other, but I guess they both represent in some ways the north. And then you've got Italy, where you have that same phenomenon. It's fascinating to me that Southern Europe, which plays the south card. Within Europe, it's like, oh my God, we got hit so hard. We need transfers. We don't need, just need loans. We need to shoulder the burden together. We all need to come into this and help us out. And yet, within Italy and Spain, now that they have their money, you're going to see the same argument play out within these countries, north versus
Right.
south. And that's politics. And I think more interesting in the Italian context is the Lega, which I think its appeal was hugely bolstered by its success in getting so many of the people in the South who originally, Five Star supporters, a little bit more, they're populist, but populist a little bit more on the left, a lot of them to join Lega. A lot of them themselves were pretty anti-immigrant, right? It'll be interesting whether that will be a rift, within Lega, or whether, I don't know, whether that will still succeed. I think the Democratic Party coalition with Five Star is still solid, right? I guess, the Lega is not doing as well as they used to do on the poll. So it'd be interesting to see where that goes politically. All right, I did want to get to this last story. I found this fascinating. This is a new study. Again, this is the National Opinion Research Center, University of Chicago, which says that Americans are more unhappy today than they've ever been in the last 50 years. That's a long time. And since basically they had data to draw on, this is 1972, drawing on data both from their recent polls as well as the General Social Survey. We ourselves have commented on a recent JAMA study. This is the Journal of the American Medical Association, which has found during the time of the pandemic lockdown a 3 to 4 times rise in emotional stress among Americans and among young adults and also among those with lower incomes and obviously more affected by the employment issues. The rise was 6 to 7 times. And these are questions like, have you felt nervous in the last week? These are kind of classical questions that have been asked. It's called a Kessel survey, but anyway, this is often used. It's a well-validated survey for talking about levels of underlying emotional anxiety. Well, NORC is now releasing its own report, which gives long-term perspective on this recent mood shift. And again, they say, yes, this is the share of Americans feeling very happy has, you know, never been lower, and the number feeling very unhappy has never been higher. There's been a huge rise in Americans who are feeling lacking companionship, isolated, left out. A big jump in the share of Americans who feel anxious, depressed, or irritable. They went back and actually compared America's reactions to earlier crisis situations like 9/11 and the JFK assassination. And it was interesting that after those earlier tragedies, Americans are actually more likely to report that they cried, they felt nervous, they, you know, had trouble sleeping, they were tensed or dazed. But after the pandemic, Americans are much more likely to just say they feel tired, irritable, on the verge of losing their temper. And compared to 9/11, Americans are much more likely to say they feel bored, depressed, or lonely. So, and this gets to another real difference. I never like to say as you recall. You know, when I'm talking to a millennial, I always have to be careful of saying that. But after these earlier tragedies, there was a very positive and powerful rally round the flag wave of emotion. And President LBJ in 1964, finishing up Kennedy's term, enjoyed a massive approval rating margin, you know, and beat Goldwater in the election of 64 with an enormous margin of electoral votes. And similarly, George W. Bush in 2002 enjoyed just a huge approval rating boost, you know, coming out of 9/11. Patriotism numbers surged. I think a lot of people who remember 9/11 remember 2002, 2003, a big surge in patriotism. Well, no such wave is happening this time around, Christian. Don't want to be a downer here, but it's not happening. Trump's approval boost was small and short-lived and has now entirely disappeared. According to Gallup, a record low share of Americans, 42%, are today extremely proud to be an American. That's down from 51% in 2017, a year into Trump's presidency, and down from 92% in 2002. Of course, that was just after 9/11. 42% today. Yeah, that's an all-time low. The mounting gloominess about national direction encompasses more than just patriotism. Gallup also reports a steep decline in Americans who say they're satisfied with the current direction of the country. According to a Monmouth University poll, they release this every month, only 21% say America is headed in the right direction, and that's down from 39% at the beginning of March. And this is really back to levels we haven't seen since, you know, the aftermath of the Great Recession. Well, it gets worse. A Wall Street Journal NBC survey recently noted, and I think I may mention on this podcast, 80% of Americans now think that America is, quote, out of control, unquote. I think only about 3% of Americans actually explicitly disagree with that. So, yeah, America's in control. And where we have demographic crosstabs, this is interesting. They seem to indicate that the largest declines in positive feelings about America's direction are happening among older and Republican-leaning adults. So, you know, so much for maybe the big buoyant, you know, the Trump buoyancy that supported him earlier in his presidency. The NORC researchers, in their investigation, they have no similar indicator about, you know, state of the nation, but they do have asked one very interesting question which points in the same direction. And the question is this: when your children are at the age you are now, do you think their standard of living will be much better, somewhat better, you know, somewhat worse, etc.? In 2020, the much somewhat better share has dropped to its lowest share since 1994, and the somewhat much or somewhat worse share has risen to its highest level since 1994. Now, the NERC data only go back to 1994, so we don't know how much further you'd go back. But I will say, just looking at the data, I've noticed this in the past. 1994 was a year of unusual gloom. We were coming out of a very long, that was the recession that made sure that George Bush Sr. was not reelected. It got Clinton elected, and it kind of dragged on. And 1994 was the famous, Newt Gingrich, contract with America campaign. It was a year of considerable gloom. We were just dragging in this long, long recession. But anyway, there you got it. But here's the last thing I want to point out about this, and this was what's fascinating. If you ask Americans how they're doing financially right now, and by the way, this ties this whole podcast together because it gets back to what I was saying about what the CARES Act and the Fed is doing. If you ask Americans about how they're doing financially right now, you wouldn't even know there's a recession going on. The satisfied share has risen, and the not at all satisfied share has declined. And most Americans actually say they're relieved that their own incomes are not more affected by the huge declines they see all around them in employment and production. So, Christian, I guess you could say that's what $3.6 trillion in deficit spending can buy you, along with another $3.1 trillion added to the Fed's balance sheet. And for that hefty price tag, you can buy a huge degree of protection from near-term economic pain. But here's my point. All that spending is not buying Americans any satisfaction at all in the just about the state of their own lives, the future of the country, or the long-term consequences for their kids. So I think the moral you can draw from this is, if the protection runs out before the economy picks back up, well, then we may see some mood numbers that are really scary. that's where the tempers will really begin to rise. So, that's my capper for today. We did want to get to the VPs, but as usual, we always bite off more than we can chew. Isn't that right? I hate to admit that.
Oh, yes.
But, we'll do that. We'll do that another time. By the way, I should mention as a closer that on Friday of this week, and I believe this is HedgeEye is opening this up for everybody to come on and listen to. I'm going to do an hour on just talking about the fourth turning. So we've got a huge backlog of questions. Actually, put out a note, send me your questions. And I'm going to be talking with Daryl Jones of HedgeEye, and we're just going to have an hour, and we're going to talk a little bit about the book, how it's done, what are my, prognostications now looking out and, looking in light of what Bill and I wrote about back in 1991 and 1997 in the year 2000. Where are we going to go? And this is all oriented above all for you, the listener, everyone who has questions about those books and had something you've always wanted to ask. I'm going to try make my diligent effort to make to answer as many questions as possible. And if I don't get to in this show, we're going to do more shows like that, because I know the single biggest thing that a lot of listeners want to hear from is, let's talk about that thesis that you wrote about lo these many years ago. And I have no problem doing that, talking about it. So great. Thanks for listening to this week's Demography Unplugged. Talk to you again next week. Thank you for joining me on this episode of Demography Unplugged. If you like what you've heard and want to dive deeper, I've got some good news for you. I'm offering a special research service for subscribers. It provides unique insights you won't see anywhere else. Deep dive analysis, charts, videos, and much more. It's designed to help professionals and investors uncover hidden trends and critical developments driving world markets and economies. You can learn more about it online at www.hedgeye.com, or you can just Google Demography Unplugged. You can also follow me on Twitter at HowGeneration. That's H-O-W-E Generation.
This content is for informational purposes and does not constitute an offer to sell or buy any investment vehicle, nor does it constitute an investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. Hedgeye believes the information sources to be reliable but is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions. The opinions expressed are those of the individual speaking. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information is protected by copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient provided access by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited and subject to the terms of service at hedgeye.com.